can you close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Captain Renault's feigned ignorance of the gambling going on around him in Casablanca may be the most famous example of authority figures denying knowledge of rampant gambling in popular culture. But the reality is, the past denials of the presence of gambling in the NFL or Major League Baseball or college basketball by authority figures like commissioners are equally implausible. While the presence of sports gambling is now very much out in the open, the reality is that gambling has always been a major part of the American sports landscape. The history of sports betting is laid out in a new book filled with great stories and colorful characters by author David Bacchino. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me here, Roger.
I wanted to sort of start out by asking you, how much fun was this book to write for somebody, you know, like an academic? But I want to be a little more clear. What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Yeah, sure. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a larger history of the sports media industry, and I'd ended that. That book came out in 2024, and me and my agent were kind of talking about what I wanted to do next. Elon University is a great place. They don't force you to write purely academic books. They want you to write books for trade audiences, general audiences, and, you know, take a piece of knowledge and make it more accessible to a larger audience. And sports betting was obviously everywhere. I've been talking about sports betting with my students since I got to Elon, right? Way before it even became legal back in 2014, we were talking about sports betting because, as we'll talk about, this has been going on for decades, if not centuries. And so sports betting became the focus of my book, and I wanted to write a history. I had a lot of fun diving into the history of sports media industry, so I started diving into the history of sports betting. The first thing I found, when you mentioned how fun was this to write, was just a series of ridiculous, hilarious, fascinating characters, decade after decade, and just stories upon stories. And I'm like, oh crap, how am I going to cut this down to an actual readable book? I got volumes here, right? I could write encyclopedias of the characters that make up this industry. And so that was my first thing that I found was just the stories and the characters. The second thing I found, and I'm sure we'll get to it, was the main thesis of the book. And so I dove into the book not thinking I was going to write a book based on a thesis, more just a straight history. And then I found this inherent idea that really links all these chapters together.
And how long did it take you to do the research and write the book?
I spent about 2 years working on the book. You know, that's everything from visiting library archives to talking to people, a lot of newspapers.com, a lot of secondary research, just diving into old magazines and old newspapers and Wayback Machine, looking at old internet sites. So it's about 2 years of work.
Well, your core thesis is that sports betting is not simply an offshoot of the multi-billion dollar American sports industry, but in fact is the reason for it. Did you start with, like you said, I don't think you started with that thesis. How did that come to you as you dug into the material?
Yeah, I didn't start with that thesis at all. I just wanted to write a straight history. You know, there's been a couple history books written about sports betting. One of the main ones came out in 1999, which you can't have you needed to update that, right? And so I started diving back, and one of the first sports I focused on was baseball. And I'm a huge baseball fan. I grew up in New York. I'm a big Mets fan. And I love reading about the history of baseball because, you know, the history of baseball, there's tons of books. Historians have been writing about the history of baseball forever. And there's no shortage of people to talk about the history of baseball with you. I started looking at the emergence of baseball in New York post-Civil War, about 1870s. And that's when people really started coming out and building the ball fields and creating the sport that we know today. You know, the rules were a little different and that's changed and people have recounted that endlessly. But what I realized was that the first people to show up to watch baseball, not necessarily play it, had wagers on the action. And you think about why they were doing that. I ran into this theory from John Thorne, who's the official historian of Major League Baseball. And he came out with this theory before he was named the official historian, which is really important. He basically said there are three components of a sport going from a local regional game to a professional sport. The first one's statistics. We need to know what's going on in the action. So you need to have some sort of basis. What's happening today? How does that relate to what happened yesterday? You need publicity, which is obvious, right? You need to tell people that the sport exists. You need to tell people about the players. And then the third component he mentioned was gambling. And he said, we need to give people a reason to care about what's happening. When a sport first emerges, we don't know who these players are. We don't know the teams. Like, you can say, hey, this represents, you know, Manhattan or Brooklyn, but we have a connection there. But when you have a group of immigrants in a city, they don't say, hey, Brooklyn's really my team, right? And so wagering gave people a reason to care about what was happening on the field. And that really spurred a lot of enthusiasm for those early baseball games in the days. And then what happened was, I said, all right, baseball was started with gambling as a huge emphasis and a huge catalyst. What about other sports? And I started checking off the boxes decade from decade. And I said, man, this is like every single sport in American history. The first people to show up were gambling.
Now, was there gambling going on back in the gladiator days in Rome?
Absolutely. And, you know, I am not an expert on gladiator gambling, but there's been gambling on sports, and people, I'm not the first person to say this by any means. There's been gambling on sports since there's been sports. And, you know, you take this idea of, all right, there's two humans going up against each other. Some reason we have a natural inclination to go, all right, Roger, you take that guy, I'll take this guy. Let's put a dollar on this, see who wins, right? And we do that all the time. And we do that today. And this has been going on, you know, forever. But there's a, you know, there's a self-centric streak in that action, in that, how can I make this a little bit about me, right? And how can I make this matchup a little bit about me? And if you know anything about humanity and humans, is that we all have a little bit of narcissism. We all try to make everything about us. And I think gambling is kind of a reflection of that.
You know, it's really interesting. Early in the book, you talk about a Harvard-Yale boat race. And, you know, at the outset, you had affinity by college students to their alma maters. And there was a natural affinity. And what's interesting is that that really wouldn't carry over into baseball. I mean, you wouldn't have this, what you just said is you wouldn't have this natural affinity. Just because there's a team in Brooklyn doesn't mean I love it, which is, I guess, why it became so important to have this sort of gambling thing added to the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to come off as thinking those regional identities don't exist now, because they absolutely do, right? They almost in some ways came after the fact, and they were manufactured by the leagues in some ways. They don't want just gambling fans. They want people who are going to root for the jerseys, not the least of which is because players come and go. And so if you're rooting for players and you're rooting for gambling, like, you don't have that loyalty to buy season tickets, to buy the jerseys, to go day after day. College was a little bit different, for sure. So you have that baked-in allegiance. You know, I went to Penn State University. I'm a Penn State fan through and through, no matter what happens, right? I'll root for any of their team sports. But what I found, even with the boat racing, even with the early football games that were going on, those guys were showing up, and it was mostly men in those days. Unfortunately, though, the women showed up later, but people were rooting for individual teams, but they were still like, you know what? Even though we have these loyalties, let's still throw money on it, because that makes it just a little bit more interesting. And again, it's kind of a way to make it a little more individualized as well. It's not only about Harvard and Yale, but now it's about me who goes to Harvard.
And how many times do you hear people at a bar, you know, around the pool table saying, come on, let's make this a little interesting. Even if it's just, the loser buys the next round.
All the time, right? And it does make it more interesting. It makes it a little fun, especially if it's, I tell the story sometimes when the horse races come on, like the Derby or something, I might do that with my family. Hey, let's throw a bunch of the numbers in a hat and we'll pull them out. And, you know, my 7 or 8 year old will pull it and be like, all right, I'm rooting for horse number 10. Just because it gives you a reason to care about what's happening instead of just 20 horses that you have no idea what the difference is between them. And so you'll see this on golf courses. You see this at pool tables. You'll see this everywhere you go, basically. And that's one thing I say often. I get the question a lot. Are you surprised at how quickly legalized gambling has taken over American sports? And my answer is always no, because I think it's always been there. We've just had a legal and technological shift that allows us to do it more. Whether that's good or bad is an entirely different question, but I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, and you said you were from New York, and that's where I'm from. I grew up outside the city, and I knew that when I was a kid, at the barbershop is where you place your book. That's where...
Yeah, oh, I mean, there were books all over the city, right? And I talk about this. They called them gambling halls, but they also called them gambling hells. So, like, they weren't the best place to hang out in, right? And it was the seedy underbelly of the city in some ways. But then it became a little bit more normalized. And, you know, my first connection to sports gambling, if you grew up in New York, were off-track betting parlors.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't really know what they were when I was a young kid, and we had them close to my house, and I said, what's this? And then eventually I became old enough where I would go in, and I go, oh, this is where you place bets on, you know, Saratoga or Aqueduct or any of the tracks around the state. And so it was always there, but we always had a bookie on campus, right? You had a bookie in your town. You knew how to play. If you wanted to place a bet, you could probably figure out how to do it. Those barriers, though, have gotten even easier with phones and websites.
Yeah, as I was reading the book, I was thinking about it was kind of like sitting at a bar with you and getting you to tell us stories about fun people. There were lots of memorable characters. I want to talk about Jimmy Widmeyer because I thought he was wonderful.
Well, that's a huge compliment, Roger, and I appreciate that. I hope I'm that fun at a bar. Maybe I was 20 years ago. But Jimmy Widmeyer, so, you know, the 1919 World Series has been told a million times. The story of the 1919 World Series, the Black Sox, and there's the quick story that usually gets told is that there were a bunch of White Sox players. They were underpaid for their work, and so they were mad. Gamblers said, hey, we'll give you money if you throw the series. They did it, and then they got banned for life by Major League Baseball. That's the quick story. There's elements of truth in there. It's not completely wrong. But I went into this book saying a lot of these stories have sort of been told. Pete Rose has been told. The White Sox have been told. How do I tell it a little bit differently? How do I bring a new perspective? And so I found this guy named Jimmy Widmeyer, and they called him King of the Newsboys. And he basically stood on the corner in Chicago selling newspapers, and eventually he became a millionaire, and it made no sense. And it was really confusing. And I'm like, how did this guy become a millionaire? They wrote a book about him. There was a journalist who was like, this guy is so fascinating that I'm going to write a book about him. Jimmy Widmeyer was known as kind of the center of Chicago gossip in a lot of ways. He knew politicians, he knew athletes, but he also had people who just bought newspapers from him. So he had this duplicity to him where he said he was a newsboy, but he was really a lot more than that. And he sort of inserted himself into the 1919 World Series. He was not a major component of the entire thing, but he ended up in a hotel room next to the White Sox players when they were talking about how they weren't being paid by some of the gamblers. So, hey, maybe we're going to go back on the fix, and maybe we're actually going to try in the next couple games. And so Jimmy Widmeyer was able to hear some of this underground gossip and turn that into a bet that he made on the World Series, and he parlayed that into even more money where he became this millionaire newsboy to the point where he drove a fancy car and he would park it a couple blocks away and walk to his newsstand because he didn't want his customers to know how much money he had. But he really just did this newsboy stuff to insert himself into daily life. And he knew everybody and he wasn't really making money off the newspapers. And I used it sort of as an entryway. I go, hey, a lot of the people we're going to talk about now are going to say one thing and do another thing. And that's fine. And they're some of the more interesting people you're ever going to meet in your life. And so Jimmy Widmeyer was a good example of that.
Well, let's go into another. How about Salvatore Salazzo?
Yeah, Tarto. So Americans love talking about the mob. They love talking about mafia. The mob, you ask any expert and they're like, the mob's not really a thing. It was a bunch of things that we like to talk about in one unified collection of people. There's an image of mafioso that we have in our minds because of Godfather, because of Goodfellas, right? And it's a guy in a dark suit with a, you know, he's tan. And I mentioned in the book, half of them were named Frank. And so it's all these guys that kind of look the same. There were also people who tried to get into organized crime who were not good at it at all. And Salazzo was one of those guys. And so in terms of fixing basketball games in the 1950s, it was happening a lot in college basketball. People were getting in the ears of these students. They weren't being paid, which, you know, students were only getting paid for the last couple of years. So think about 70 years ago, and they say, hey, I'll give you $100 if you shave some points, which make the spread a little bit lower so that I can win this bet. And so there's people chirping in these kids' ears, and they were taking money and throwing games. And some of the biggest teams in basketball at that time were actually accused and of fixing games, and some of these players got in trouble. And Tarto was one of those, is his nickname. And he wanted to get involved in it. And he thought he'd be good at it. He was terrible at it. He was a terrible gambler. He fell into some business luck, but he was really bad at gambling. So he said, you know what, I'm going to get into the game fixing business instead of actually gambling. But he turned out to be terrible at that as well. And so he got a couple players on his side. Those players, you know, ended up basically snitching to the police on him. And Tarto ended up being sent back to Italy, where he came from. And so there's a short chapter, and I really reveled not in him, but there was an author named Robert Rice who wrote about him, and he just loved taking shots at Tarto over and over again. And I love when I hear other authors who are like, man, you're having fun constructing these sentences. And so I borrowed liberally from that report because I gave him credit for it. I'm like, listen, this guy needs, more people need to read this chapter, because we think of these mob guys as all tough, and it's okay to make fun of them, because some of them were kind of jokes.
Now, what did he do? How did he blow it with fixing games?
So, like, he was working with individual college basketball players who basically didn't keep their mouths shut. And so they were ended up, and he talked to too many people. He spread his knowledge around too wide, and he didn't have a firm control like some of these other guys had in terms of making sure these guys didn't talk to the authorities. And so it all came crashing down when they ended up talking, which he should have gotten in trouble, right? He tried to fix a college basketball game. So it all made sense, but he was also bad at some other stuff. Rice talks about how he was bad at business. And then what he was really bad at was gambling. And so he would always pick the wrong side, which I just thought was hilarious, because there's people like that now who always pick the wrong side, and they try to come in a different way to sports betting in order to make their money, because they just pick wrong side after wrong side. And you know, we're all friends like that, right? It's like, I got to fade that guy because he's always picking the wrong side. And so Tarto ended up, you know, back in Sicily.
You mentioned OTB, and yeah. I want to talk a little bit about why horse racing, as we talk about the arc of how American society moved toward more legalization of gambling, it seems to me that horse racing was originally considered different and more appropriate for legalized gambling. Why was that?
Yeah, so horse racing, you know, there's always been gambling on horse races. It's a huge financial foundation of horse racing in terms of getting the purses. You know, people come in and that's plays a big part in setting the purses for those individual races. Horse racing had this weird thing where it was an affluent activity. It was an activity for affluent demographic, right? And so they would come to the tracks and they would bet on horses. And there was this idea that horse racing existed in order to improve the breed of horses for military purposes. And so there were a lot of bills introduced where it was like, okay, a bill to allow gambling because we need to improve the breed of these horses for military purposes, which is just a hilarious concept. Not totally false, but it was part of the truth. But it was really just to cover for a bunch of rich people to be able to bet on their horses because they had a blast betting on their horses, right? And so when you would go to the track, and not all the tracks again, but a lot of the tracks, you would dress up in a nice outfit. You would sit in a box. You would look very put together and sophisticated. And it developed this facade of sophistication that other sports betting didn't, where it was like, well, of course we're betting on horse racing. That's what we've always done. And it's not a seedy underbelly of the city. This is this is Saratoga Springs. And so it's okay that we're betting on horses because it's imbued, it's inherent in the horse racing culture. And there were a couple people that emerged, including the Colonel. I talk about him in Kentucky Derby, who really played to this facade that horse racing built around it about being an acceptable component of this particular sport. And he dressed nice and he wined and dined journalists and he drank whiskey and he had a fancy mustache and he wore a hat. And it was like, oh, we're at the Derby. This is all, you know, fancy. Betting's okay when this comes in. And then I think the last component that really happened was that in early horse racing betting, you had a bookmaker and you had and the bettor, right? And the bookmaker always had more information than you. And so a lot of these bettors got screwed because they knew maybe a horse was injured or something, and the bettor didn't know that. And so the bookmaker could really cash in. But then this way of gambling emerged called parimutuel betting, which is how horse racing works now. And it came from it came from overseas. It came from this Frenchman, and it was called betting amongst each other, right? And so if me and you, Roger, all both bet on the same horse, and then more people came in and said, all right, we all think this horse is going to win, the odds of that horse paying out would go really far down. And so it might win, but we might all win just a tiny amount of money because we all bet on the same horse. Now, if I bet on the long shot and he came through, he would win. And then what would happen is the track would get a cut, right? A guaranteed cut of all the money that was bet. And so it became like, hey, we're just betting amongst each other and we're just putting our money into a pool. And then where whoever picks the right horse is going to come away with something. And so there wasn't a good side and a bad side in that way. It was just people doing it together. And that sort of lent itself to being more okay than the other style, which is I'm working with this bookmaker who's trying to screw me over any way he can.
I don't know if you've done it, but I've been to horse racing and didn't bet. And it was an extremely boring afternoon. I don't see the sense in horse racing without the gambling going on.
No, I mean, because they don't have personalities. Well, I shouldn't say that. Horse people will come after me and be mad, but I'm sure horses have personalities. But, you know, you see horse 17 and horse 19, and to me, you go, they both look like okay horses. That's fine. But you bet on names, right? Which is crazy. It's like, oh, I like that name. So you're from New York, or if there's a horse named after like an old Met or something, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go with the Seaver horse.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the Seaver horse. And so you attach yourself, but yeah, it's really not, to me, I agree with you. It's not that interesting if you don't have money on it.
You know, we talk about things that changed and made a big difference. We touched a few minutes ago on point sharing, but let's take a step back and talk about who are the key figures behind the development of the point spread itself, and why is the point spread so important?
The point spread's probably the most consequential gambling invention of all time. The only person that says that's nuts. I'm not breaking new ground here, but it changed everything about sports betting. And so to really understand the point spread, you got to go back to the 1930s. And there was a popular game called football parlay cards. And they were way more popular than we thought. And so Americans, millions and millions of Americans at that time played football cards. And, you know, one of the journalists at the time called it America's fastest growing industry. And what it was, just small sheets of paper with a list of college football games. And if you picked a certain amount of college football games, you got like a jackpot. So I'd put in 10 cents. I might win $5 if I can pick the winners of, you know, 6 to 10 college football games. The reason college football was used and not professional, the NFL was around. It was struggling for a lot of years. We'll get to that in a second. But there was volume. And so people who put together these cards would look for college football games that were basically 50-50 coin flips, right? And so they'd have to pick ones that were even so that, and they wouldn't all be even, but for the most part, so that people would lose. Because, you know, flipping a coin 6 times and getting heads all 6 times is very difficult to do. And that's the same way as picking these cards. So college football became really the first big betting football entity in the United States. The NFL was around, but games were really lopsided. And so people couldn't bet on them. And that's one of the reasons the NFL struggled with popularity for so long is that the teams were really lopsided. Around, you know, in the 1930s at some point, there's a lot of disagreement. And it's a little opaque about who actually was the first to invent the point spread. But there was a guy named Edward Lickenhouse. And I talk about him in my book. And he came up with these things called the lit ratings. And so he would assign numbers to certain college football teams. So he'd say, okay, Alabama, you're an 85. And then he'd say, all right, Elon University, you're a 10. And so if you wanted to figure out who would win the game, and he was like this genius. He studied at Vanderbilt University. He was a scientist. He went to Singapore, did some stuff there. So he did a lot of things, Lickenhouse. But he would say, you would take the 85, subtract the 10. Alabama is generally expected to beat Elon by 75 points, which is not inaccurate in 2026.
You're underrating your Pirates there, David. Come on.
I know. I love the Phoenix. All right. Maybe that's a little much. You would have that difference, right? And he didn't present it as a number, though. He had it as the team. So he didn't invent the point spread, but he was like right there, right? He was like on the 2-yard line. And so there was another guy who usually gets credit for inventing the point spread. His name's Charles McNeil. He was a teacher for a while. He taught in Manhattan, actually. And then he became like a trader and worked in finance. And he was a really savvy gambler. And supposedly he was one of the first to say, hey, let's use this for bookmaking purposes. And what you do then is you take any matchup and you make it more equal. Because now if you have the Packers favored by 12 over the Bears, was once a 50-50 proposition where you couldn't get people to bet on the Bears. Now you're looking at relativity, right? And it makes it way more interesting for the better. And the emergence of the point spread coincided with the emergence of the NFL. There's a lot of reasons why the NFL gained popularity. The point spread's certainly a huge reason why, because people then were able to gamble on those games. That's what keeps people interested in games today. There's a newspaper account of Super Bowl I where the game was a blowout. It was the Packers and the Chiefs, and the reporter at the time said, hey, this game was decided by halftime, but the point spread wasn't decided until the fourth quarter. And thank goodness, because that's what kept people glued to the television set, because they had money on the point spread, not the particular side.
So before the internet, how was information about point spreads distributed so that it would get to my local bookie? How did this sort of information system work?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there were wire services, right? And so there was also phone calls. So there were people who set point spreads in certain locations around the United States. Minnesota became a huge hub. There's a guy named Leo Hirschfield there, Athletic Publications. And in the 50s, he was known as the guy who set a lot of the point spreads. And so people would pay him to come up with these numbers that they thought would work for their particular books. And it became the hub of sports betting information. And he would pass it around to different bookies. And a lot of this stuff was illegal. And so it got to the point where the government ended up passing a law saying you can't transport wagering information over state lines. And that's what really knocked it down and kind of pushed that world to Vegas. But there were experts who were good at making point spreads. You know, it's not easy to do. Everyone, you talk to any football fan, they're like, oh, I can figure out what the point spread is. But you know, one of the keys about point spreads, they're not predictions. They're a way to create two sides. And whether or not, you know, bookmakers could be heavy on one side if they think that that's the side that they should be on. It's not necessarily a 50-50 proposition. Sometimes it is, but it's not. The bookmakers aren't going, well, I think the Cowboys are going to beat the Redskins or the Commanders by 7 points, right? It's really the bookmaker saying, what's a line I can post where I'm going to get a good amount of money on each side that I'm comfortable with, where in the long run, I'm going to make money? And there were people way more adept at doing that than others.
You know, you tell one story about how a point spread came out, it had to move, and the bookies ended up totally getting screwed because we had winners on both sides. I think that was a Pittsburgh Steeler game.
Yeah, so I forget what year what that is, but it was in the 70s or early 80s or something, but that's called a middle, right? And so savvy bettors will be able to bet one side, and if the line then moves enough, you can bet the other side where you're basically going to win no matter what. And, you know, it's hard to do it. It's not nearly as easy as you make it sound, but that's when bookmakers really get screwed, is when they get middled. And the savviest bettors are the ones who take advantage of stuff like that. If you talk to any pro bettor now, they're not just looking at one book and going, oh, 3.5. Okay. I'm going to, you know, take this side. They're looking at all the books, and they're like traders, man, like in finance, and you're looking at cents and how do I get the best of the number, and how do I take advantage of all these different spreads to the best where I'm almost guaranteed a winning payday. And, you know, that's almost impossible to do, but you need to use all those numbers to your advantage. And so there are even pro bettors in the past who have artificially inflated certain numbers with a lot of money and then rushed in on the other side. Billy Walters was famous for this, one of the most famous bettors of all time, probably the most famous bettor. But I just read Art Manteris's book, who was a bookmaker in Vegas for many years. And he said Walters used to do this all the time. He put a ton of money on one side, the line would move, and then he'd come in with even more money on the other side because he artificially moved the line. It's not really artificial. He moved the line. He did it for a purpose to do it on the other side.
It's almost, as you were saying, with the middling, it's almost like arbitrage in trading.
Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's absolutely like arbitrage. I didn't want to get into that because I can't speak too sophisticatedly on financial markets, but that's absolutely what it's like. Yeah.
You know, we touched a few minutes ago about on point shading, because once you have a spread, it gives the ability for corruption to allow you to still win the game, but only win it by less than you were supposed to and pay off your bettors. Talk a little bit about the first big point shaving scandals in college basketball.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was talking about with Tarto Salazzo, right? Is this idea that it used to be, hey, can you blow this game for me? You know, boxing was has been one of the most corrupt sports ever in American history. And that's one of the reasons, I don't know how many people think about this, but like, it's easy to throw a boxing match, right? You go there, you take a punch, you fall down, go, I can't go anymore, and done. It's over. Team sports are a lot more complicated. You not only have the logistics of throwing a game as like a baseball player or a football player, but you also have just the morality of it. It's like, oh, I'm letting all my teammates down. Point shaving makes it a little bit easier. So if you're up by 12 and, you know, they say, hey, win by 8 or fewer, you might miss a couple shots at the end of the game and you're like, hey, this is a win-win for me. I just won $1,000 from this gambler, but also my team won, so they don't really care. And so that became the justification for a lot of these athletes who didn't really need justification, if you ask me, because they weren't being paid. They were being exploited. College athletes got exploited for years. But they were able to, the argument was made a lot easier when you could just shave points and get it down to an acceptable level.
And it probably came to the public view by people bragging about it, you know, going out to a bar afterwards and bragging, yeah, I got an extra $1,000. We won. And
I mean, you're talking about 19-year-olds who this fell into some money. Like, I was an idiot at 19. I'm probably still an idiot. But think about, yeah, you're going to brag to your friends about that. That's what the people who had this under wraps were the ones who were able to prevent people from talking like that. Tarto wasn't one of them. And so they went out and just kind of ruined the whole thing. And that's why he got in trouble.
You discussed this concept of sports betting dope and even talk about, you know, a guy who, when I was growing up, was this hero, Johnny Unitas, right? And these people who got in the business of sort of selling dope. And it's not the dope that you, it's not a drug. It's information. Explain what sports betting dope is and how this industry grew.
I think to some people it is a drug, Roger. And so this idea of information. So what's funny about the word dope, and I love that I kind of use this word a lot in the book, and that doping, the idea, we all know what doping is, right? That's when Lance Armstrong, right, was accused of doping and injecting yourself with something in order to prove your performance. One of the first instances of doping had to do with horses. And so I actually found this amazing newspaper article, I forget what year it was, 100 years ago, and where they were talking about the concoctions that people were putting into horses in order to improve their performance. And we're not talking just caffeine, we're talking cocaine, heroin. They were injecting them with strychnine, which I still don't understand how that makes a horse run faster. These concoctions, and they were saying, we're doping horses in order to improve their performance. The word was then used in terms of information because bettors always want to improve their chance of winning whatever bet they're doing. So instead of actually doping athletes or horses, now you're just improving your knowledge base, right? And increasing the amount of information you have at your disposal. And so this term became dope, where people would sell information to bettors and people would buy it. And it became one of the most profitable parts of the sports betting industry because every bettor thinks that they're going to become even better if they have more information at their disposal. And you see people to track all the time. I used to spend time at Aqueduct in Queens. And you'd see, and they'd have their sheets, and they'd go, oh, yeah, I know the history of this horse. He runs on, you know, this type of track. And they're usually wrong. Sometimes they're right, but they like to convince themselves that they're wrong. And think about the information ecosystem we have today with football, how many podcasts there are, how many articles are written. And a lot of that is to improve just our knowledge of our favorite team, right? But a lot of it is say, hey, I heard that they lost 2 offensive linemen. Therefore, we should take the under on their wins for this season because, you know, I have this knowledge that I think is going to help me with betting. And so selling information to bettors became really huge. And it started with magazines and it started, it moved into, you know, people on TV were giving information. And now it's obviously what you see on the internet and social media. And everyone says, I have the winning key. Give me money and I'll give you that winning key.
Yeah, you see these ads that say, you know, guaranteed 6 winners. And I assume that most of this stuff is all garbage, right? That they really don't have anything that anybody else doesn't have.
I mean, it's been going on for years. There are pro bettors who are very good. If you talk to any pro bettor, if you can make, you know, 60% of your bets, right, you're a genius. And so anyone saying they're making 80, 90% of their correct bets, they're lying. But this has been going on for decades and decades. It's just more visible now because of social media. But people were selling ads in like sports magazines in the 1970s and 80s saying, call guaranteed winning picks. And what these people would do is half the people, say there's a game, again, Bears-Packers. They'd give half the people the Bears, half the people the Packers. The Bears people would be like, oh, my God, this guy's a genius. And they'd go back and pay him. The people, in the if the Packers lost, they'd say, oh, this guy's an idiot. I'm never going to call him again. But you have that 50% who's going to come back. And then you take that group and you go 50%. It's almost like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah,
and you start getting more people. And as long as you can get new people signed up, you're going to make money. There's going to be eventual end date, which most of these guys have an end date.
Yeah, I imagine some of the doping, you know, some of the information they got back in the 70s, let's say you were a bartender in Queens. And Tommy Agee's at the bar, you know, the night before a big game. And, you know, you saw how much he drank and you sell the information. It's like, I think Tommy's going to be hungover. Just hit the center field and, you know, you're good to go.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And so, you know, the guy I mentioned in Minnesota, Leo Hirschfeld, he did a lot of newspaper profiles and he was adamant. He goes, I don't have insiders around the country. I don't have anyone. I look at the newspapers, I read the news, and I have a proprietary system. They all love to have their proprietary systems, right? The truth is, a lot of the people who were having this dope had those insiders plastered around the country. Some of them were accused of basically paying college students. And so when you're talking about, hey, give me some information about this quarterback at Penn State, right? And this is, we have to remember, a lot of this was before, I mean, this still goes on today, but a lot of this was before just the rampant, the crazy information world that we have now, where we know everything about everybody. But that's absolutely right. And if you get that information, it was worth a lot, because if Tommy Agee's not playing, you know, that could move the line directly. And now I'm going to bet against the Mets and I might make money off that.
Doing the reference to Casablanca and this willingness to disregard what was really going on, I was thinking about Burt Bell and Pete Rozelle and how the NFL held itself out as this pantheon of virtue that would never be corrupted by something like gambling. Talk a little bit about how they addressed the issue of gambling in the NFL during their relative regimes as heads of the, as commissioners.
I mean, the best part about the NFL is it was a league literally founded by gamblers. All the initial owners were gamblers. They used money from gambling to build their teams. They weren't hiding that. It was just, hey, this is what we were doing. And then when they built a sport that was perfect for gambling, they said, hey, nobody better be gambling on this. Let's just keep that out of it. They knew people were gambling on it. Like, these guys were pretty smart. They knew that there was gambling going on. And so what they were worried about, though, because it was a new league, they were talking about the integrity of the game. And so because it was so new, they thought that if it came out that games were being rigged, that fans would then say, oh, screw this. This is a new league. I'll just go watch baseball again. And so they were very protective of the image, the reputation. You know, Pete Rozelle's famous. He's a PR guy. He came up through PR ranks. And he would always say, what's more important than your character is your reputation. I'm butchering. He had an exact quote. That wasn't it. But it was all about reputation, right? He talked about reputation. And so he wanted to ensure that the NFL had a stellar reputation and that there was no shenanigans going on behind the scenes in terms of game fixing. To do that, he didn't want people to think that it was a league watched by gamblers, because then they would assume, if there's gamblers watching that, then people are being paid to basically shave points and fix games. And so they did everything they could to say there was no gambling, while gambling really helped build the popularity of the NFL and still does to this very day.
And of course, I want to talk a little bit about Joe Namath, because, you know, he was this wonderful figure that pops in 1968 or so, charismatic, good looking, writes this biography called, his autobiography, I think it was called, I Can't Wait Till Tomorrow Because I Get Better Looking Every Day, which I remember at the age of 13 buying that book and, you know, being a real Namath fan, neither here nor there. Talk a little bit about the example of how the NFL treated Namath, to me, is just wonderfully illustrative of this sort of hypocrisy and silliness.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wasn't lucky enough to live through the Namath years. I wish I did, because when I was a
vintage-year-old,
it's hard to imagine that there's a player like equal to that sort of fame. When he came in, he was very cocky. He was very arrogant. He basically was able to matched that cockiness with his performance on the field in a lot of ways. He was also in New York City in the 60s and 70s, where a lot went. He did interviews with Playboy talking about, you know, his love life, and he talking about his garish living room and bedroom.
Do you remember the quote he gave about how he liked his women blonde and his Johnny Walker black?
Yeah, that, like, he was, journalists loved the guy, right? Because he was so quotable. You know, as someone who teaches sports media for a living, I get so bummed out by just the sanitized social media profiles of some of these athletes, because some of these guys are hilarious. Thank God for podcasts, because some of their characters actually come out in the podcast. But the profiles stink because they're so boring. Think about what Joe Namath would have done with an Instagram in 1968. It would have been awesome. So he used to admit that he would drink before games, right? He would be like, hey, it calms me down, and I take women home before games, and it calms me down. So you're talking about an athlete who's about as showboaty as you can get in the biggest media market in football, who just came off a Super Bowl. And he decided to open a bar, right, with his friends. And the bar was being frequented by characters that weren't approved by the NFL. And there was gambling going on over the phone. And I believe Roselle called it the wrong kind of people in some ways, right? The wrong kind of people. And Joe Namath ended up being suspended from the NFL. And they said, hey, you got to get rid of the bar or you can't play in the NFL anymore. He said, I'm not doing anything. I own a bar. I don't know what happens there. My friends own it. And they said, no, we don't want that association. And so it's crazy to think about, but they suspended basically the most popular player in the NFL for owning a bar where stuff went on. And, you know, he probably knew more about it than he let on, but stuff was going on in the bar. And he said, screw it, I'm not going to play in the league anymore. And they ended up coming to a truce, and he ended up being allowed back into the league. The paternal nature of just Roselle being like, how dare you hang out with those people? Can you imagine Roger? I mean, it does kind of happen today still a little bit with Goodell and Adam Silver, and they say, hey, be careful. And, you know, it probably happens more behind the scenes with PR people. But it's crazy that they were able to do that. But that's how worried they were about gambling. And that worry continued until about, you know, 8 years ago, where they were like, you know what? FanDuel's going to get, DraftKings will give us $200 million. It'll just take the cash and run.
Hey, let's jump back into college basketball. How important is gambling to the growth of March Madness in the NCAA?
Yeah, so I find this fascinating. It's something I talk about in classes all the time. What a lot of people don't understand, you know, unless you're a sport management major in our department, is that 60 or 70% of all the NCAA's money comes from the men's March Madness tournament media rights. So CBS pays the NCAA, and more than half of the NCAA's revenue for the year comes from that particular tournament. That tournament is by far the most wagered on event, multi-game event in the United States. So basically what you have is the NCAA making money from an event that people are gambling on. And yet the NCAA has traditionally been the most anti-gambling entity out there, which I understand where they're coming from. They don't want their athletes to be corrupted. Like, I'm not saying they shouldn't be this. There's just so much intertwined, and I don't want to call it hypocrisy, but there's a lot of layers there that you can't unfurl. Because if you took away, well, there's another layer to this too. Is me playing a bracket tournament with my coworkers for $5 gambling? I would say yes, because it's fun, but the line is far, like, what becomes gambling? But I would also say it's perfectly fine. You should be able to do that because it's really fun, right? But you could say it is betting. It is because I'm putting in a little bit of money to make a lot of money. That's what I'm doing. And I'm rooting for athletes to do something so that I can make money. That to me is betting in some ways. Is there a difference between that and just betting pitch by pitch of a Major League Baseball game? Yeah, absolutely. But it's still betting in some ways. It's still gambling. And so if you took away bracket tournaments from March Madness, what would happen to the ratings? We have, the NCAA does not want to know, right? Because then are you watching that 5-12 matchup on that Thursday till the end and seeing, oh, my bracket's ruined, right? And so maybe we are, because there is a lot of drama. I'm not saying no one would watch it, but there would be a lot fewer people tuning into those early games if they didn't have a bracket. And so that, it's again, inserting yourself into this competition in some ways. How do I get involved? How can I make this a little bit about me? Because that's fun. It's fun to make it about us. And so I always found it pretty funny that the NCAA derives so much money indirectly from the most wagered on event in America.
I mean, you were just mentioning that almost, you know, playing the brackets is gambling. And here we're a ski town. Even if you're skiing with your friends, you say, hey, last one down buys the round of beers. I mean, that's gambling. You know, you're risking the fact that you're buying a few of your buddies some beers.
Yeah. And I think people would have, would take issue with that. But, you know, so where do I draw the line then? Mm-hmm. When does it become gambling? If you bet a nickel for a hole in golf, like, it's still a nickel, right? It's still money being involved. And so to say, hey, that's not gambling, but if we bet $10, it's gambling. I don't know. It's a fine line that becomes tricky. And I think it just goes to show, yeah, I'm going to bet us how fast can you ski down this hill? That's inherent in us. Just, all right, my kids do that, right? Oh, I'll beat you down, right? Or let's race to the mailbox.
Yeah.
It's like that. And so once you attach money to it, it's just part of our nature. And that's why I'm not surprised when the legal boundary came up, how quickly people were like, I'll throw a couple bucks on this NFL game, sure.
I want to talk about Pete Rose for a minute, because you think about, many people view him as this tragic figure in the sense that he was this unbelievably vibrant, competitive baseball player that you had to admire his on-the-field performance. But yet he's banned from baseball for life because of his gambling. You talk a little bit about how it was almost inevitable that from his background that Pete Rose would end up as a gambler.
Yeah, and that's a tricky conversation to have because, you know, gambling is an addiction. Gambling is an addictive quality. You can be addicted to gambling, 100%. I'm not an addictive, you know, addiction specialist, but it is very much an addictive quality that can get out of control and ruin your life in a lot of ways. And Pete Rose, from everything that doctors looked at, was a gambling addict. Now, what a lot of people in this book, we talked about this in the beginning, I tried to approach topics from different perspectives. Like, what's a new wrinkle that, you know, Pete Rose talked about for decades? It's our favorite gambling conversation. Hey, should it be in the Hall of Fame? Yes or no? And it kind of sparks off a lot of stuff. Everyone's had that conversation. So I was like, what's a new angle that people haven't kind of approached it from? And it turns out that Pete Rose grew up a couple miles from what one newspaper called the nerve center of U.S. sports gambling. It was called Newport, Kentucky, right? If you've ever been to Cincinnati, it's right over the river. And that's where a ton of gambling was going on when he was growing up. And not only sports betting, but, you know, they had card games, table games. All of it was happening just mere stone's throw from his house. His dad would go to horse tracks all the time and bring Pete. It was just normal part of his life. He was playing high school football and people were betting on it. And so Pete Rose grew up in a culture where people were just gambling on everything. And so when he became, you know, a professional and had money, it made a lot of sense. He's like, I'm a gambler. That's what I do. This is what I grew up doing. And so it makes a lot of sense when you look at his background about what he, you know, what happened to him. Now, I don't want to make Pete Rose into a sympathetic character. Pete Rose dug a lot of his holes, his own holes, right? And he handled the situation poorly. He lied a ton. He backtracked. He changed his story. I think he would be in the Hall of Fame if he had changed his tune a long time ago. Maybe. I do think he probably could have gotten there eventually. I also think he will be in the Hall of Fame eventually. But he was very standoffish. He said, hey, I'm addicted. And he goes, nah, it was just a hobby. I wasn't addicted. So he's changed that a lot. But it's very obvious why Pete Rose became so attracted to gambling when you look at his childhood. And he said he met his first wife at a horse track. And he said his first date with a second wife was at a horse track. It was just part of who he was. And it didn't work out well for him in the end. But he's still a baseball legend. And we'll see. I think he'll eventually make it into the Hall of Fame, personally.
All along, the various guardians of the sports, whether it's baseball commissioners, NFL commissioners, have said that their fear of gambling was that it would corrupt the integrity of the sport and sort of encourage an environment where, you know, people wouldn't enjoy the games because they wouldn't think they were real. This latest indictment, which you don't get to in the book, but this latest indictment where we had players indicted for misbehaving on what, for lack of a better term, we'll call prop bets. How many foul shots will I make? The existence of these multi-layered prop bets have created an environment where a single player, you know, you talked about how team sports, where a single player, people can bet on a single player's conduct, and a single player can move the needle. Talk a little bit about the dangers that you see from this sort of prop bet environment, and whether or not, I know those latest indictments, I look at those and go, wow, makes me wonder about every game I'm watching.
Yeah, there's a couple angles on this. And so the first one is, if you talk to people who support widespread legalized gambling, they will say, this was always going on. We're just catching it now, in which case we have improved the system. And these sort of small little infractions were happening in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and we didn't know about them. So that's people who support widespread legalized gambling and saying, we have a better system than we used to. People who are saying, no, there's more game fixing because there's more opportunities to bet, are the ones who are saying, no, this is corrupting the very soul of the sports. My take on all this is that until I see proof that audiences actually care about fixed games, we've had, I'm going to believe that it's going to not stop Americans from watching sports. We've had problem after problem since 2018. We've had a series of events. We had a referee where there's credible evidence in the NBA in the 2000s, right? Basically fixing games. An ESPN reporter went back and looked at it and said, hey, there's evidence that Tim Donaghy basically fixed a lot of these games in the 2000s. And the NBA is doing great. The ratings for Knicks Spurs are through the roof. And so there's very little evidence that the audience is actively saying, hey, I'm worried about this. So until I see that, I do not think gambling will corrupt sports, because I think people are going to keep watching. And unless people stop watching, nobody at the league level, I think, is going to really do anything about it.
And I know I'll be watching the Knicks and the Spurs series as it continues. The book is Over Under, author David Bucchino. Wonderful set of stories. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
I appreciate you having me on. This was fun.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to our show, whether you're listening to the radio or streaming us on your device.
We'd also like to thank our guest, David Bucchino. We hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we did. Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.